It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today, we're looking back at our favorite science and sci-fi guests from 2014. Just as it would be difficult for TV viewers to imagine Saturdays without Saturday Night Live, it would be equally challenging for public radio listeners to contemplate Fridays without Science Friday. The weekly call-in program engages listeners and scientists in lively conversations about all things science, and you can hear it here on 90.5 WESA on Fridays from 2 to 4 p.m. The host of Science Friday is Ira Flatow, an award-winning NPR science reporter who spent 6 years writing and hosting the well-remembered Emmy Award-winning Newton's Apple on PBS, as well as reporting on science for CBS. Ira Flatow started Science Friday as a radio show back in 1991, so it's been nearly a quarter of a century that the program has been on the air. Ira joined us back in June during a visit to Pittsburgh and talked about the interesting ways Science Friday has evolved in that time.
As you say, we started out as a radio program, and it was a talk show. It still is a talk show where we bring scientists on. And we have listeners able to interview scientists and see, hey, yeah, I talked to a scientist today. But we are now living in a digital age, and we recognize that we're living in a digital age. So we have gone in that direction also. So one of the first things we did, noticing that YouTube, for example, was becoming very popular, we started making videos. And we made videos that had to do with what we were talking about on the radio that week, or it didn't. And we just found interesting things to do. We had sometimes scientists would send us their raw video of stuff that they were doing. And our most popular video called Where's the Octopus? And you will want to see this. Over a million people have downloaded it. Is video scientists sent us when he was out searching for an octopus surprised him underwater. And it's a little adventure with an octopus.
I think I've seen this. Yeah. I've seen this. Does the octopus try to take the guy's camera?
No, this is where the octopus – he doesn't see the octopus because the octopus is so good at camouflaging itself that he's hiding inside a sponge. And you think that this is a giant sponge sitting in the water. And as he gets close to it, it just jumps out at him, changing color, shape, size, everything. And he like – swallows his respirator, his equipment, and jumps. He's only in 5 feet of water. They think he's having a heart attack or something in the water when he just suddenly this thing just surprises him. So he follows it with his camera, and it starts walking along the bottom. First it inks him and then swims away. And he watches how it turns into every shape that it passes. It passes a rock, and now the octopus turns into the shape of that rock, and you can't tell it's an octopus. I'm a rock, and then it finds another thing, and now I'm a sponge again, and it goes into the sponge and becomes that sponge. And it can do this, as he studies it, it's colorblind. Even though it's matching all the colors and things, it can't see the colors. And so he investigates it and sees how its skin is made up of looks like a video screen. It's got all kinds of red, white, and blue dots and things on it, and it can just change not only the color but the texture to feel like a rock, look like a rock. So we discovered these things that scientists were sending us, and we started making them into videos. And then we started making our own videos about things that we would go out and collect, everything ranging from an outhouse that's on a canoe, and that's totally bio, sensitive, to the science of wine, how wine snobbery, how you can be influenced by what someone says a wine is. And we actually created a test. We videoed our staff, brought in some wine experts and said, this is a great bottle of wine, isn't it? And if I told you it was, you agreed, even though it was crummy wine, and vice versa. So we started doing all those videos, and we started becoming very active on Facebook and Twitter and Second Life for a while. We're on Second Life. And we have the largest social community in all of public radio. You combine it all together.
A growing audience.
Our Twitter audience grows 1,000 a week. So
how did Science Friday get its start back in 1991? Who came up with the idea? Was it you?
Yeah, it was me. I came up with the idea, and I had worked at NPR for decades, and so I was working in television on Newton Zeppelin, and I'd written a couple of books, and I wanted to get back into radio with some other idea. So I listened to what was being popular on radio. And on commercial radio, it was the launching of talk radio. A lot of talk radio shows are coming out, and most of them were from, you know, the conservative side. And so I went to NPR and I said, I'd like to do a science show, you know. And they said, well, you know, we don't have very many talk shows, national talk shows. I said, well, let's start one. Let's just give me a day and I'll do – I started out as a Thursday because the
– That doesn't have the same ring. Science Thursday.
But it was the day and it still is the day where most science research is open to the public. It's a deadline. It's open to the public. And so I said, well, we could be the first with the news if we do it on that Thursday. So they said, well, how do we get the stations interested in this? And what are we going to do the other 4 days of the week? And I said, well, I'll start working on the other 4 days. And I started going around to other local talk show people or people I thought could be talk show hosts, Diane Rehm or Susan Stamberg and people like that. They said, okay, well, come back to me when you get the whole thing. We'll talk about it. And then the Gulf War happened, 1990, and sort of Saddam Hussein bailed me out on this one. when he created the Gulf War, NPR started broadcasting a daily talk show about what was happening during that day in the war. And as we know, that war only lasted a short period, but it sort of whet the appetite of the stations to have a national talk show, and they started a national talk show. And they said, okay, we have to create a block, so you can do the first – we'll do the first 4 days, Talk of the Nation, and you do Friday, Science Friday. And so over the years, Talk of the Nation had 4 or 5 hosts, and I've been on there for 23 years. And we created a separate identity, basically. There was Science Friday, then there was Talk of the Nation. And when Talk of the Nation went away, NPR discontinued it, we stayed on because we have a whole separate – you know, people consider us different, and they know that we're a different show. And so we've been very successful now, even after we left Talk of the Nation, we left NPR, we have 100,000 more listeners this year than we had last year.
What are the challenges of explaining science on the radio where you can't always demonstrate a lot of the ideas that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, you try to find analogies to them. You know, you try to find and you have to find speakers and scientists who are good at explaining things, you know, who are great speakers. They can find analogies themselves. They can find why it's relevant to your life. You know, the first question that a scientist always gets, especially in basic research, is, so what? You know, how is this going to affect me? How does you knowing the age of the universe good for anything? And, you know, well, so what? You know, how is you discovering dark energy or dark matter? How is that going to affect my life? And the greatest answer, you know, I got to that question when I asked a scientist recently, is this good for anything? And there's a long pause and he said, no. And that was a very good answer because sometimes knowledge for the sake of the knowledge leads to us to another place that we don't know where it's heading. And lots of basic research starts out as we don't know where it's heading and it winds up with a product or something that makes us better. But it also answers a basic question that everybody asks about life and nature is where do we come from and where are we going? So there are philosophers and theologians and all kinds of people ask that question and science tries to answer that question. And everybody wants to know what that answer is as you go along. And the answer is always changing because science doesn't tell us anything. Science sort of gives us a snapshot of what we know now. And what we know now is different than what we knew. We used to know the Earth was flat. The Earth is not flat anymore. We know it's something else because we've done research. And so what science does is it says, as Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, said, just ask a question and then find a way to get the data to figure it out. And that's basically what science does.
So, Ira, what is that Hadron Collider really good for anyway? What are we getting out of all that?
Well, it's going to try to answer the question of what the universe is made out of. I mean, we don't know what 95% of the universe is made out of. That's incredible. You know, you want to feel small? Here we are in the 20th tree, and only thing that we know what the universe is made out of is stuff that we can see. We see the stars, the galaxies. We see your microphone. But that's only 5% visible universe. 95% of the universe is invisible. We first discovered years ago that there must be something. You see these galaxies, they all rotate in beautiful ways. But when you did the math on all the stuff that you could see, there wasn't enough mass to gravitationally hold that beautiful rotating galaxy together. So there must be something invisible in there. And they decide, yeah, there's, and if it's invisible there, it's got to be invisible everywhere. And when they started doing the math on that, they said, well, wait a minute. That's, you know, that's only a few percentage, maybe 20% of what the universe is made out of. What else could it be? And then they discovered about 8-10 years ago that that there was a strange repulsive force that Einstein had talked about and said this was he put it in his equations to say the universe is actually expanding. He said this was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my life. He said wrote that and he took it out. But now we put it back in because there's something happened. Something happened a few billion years into the age of the universe that kicked in like warp drive, you know, and started expanding the universe outwards instead of making it collapse. And we don't know what that is. And that makes up that energy, that dark energy makes up 75% of the universe. We don't know what it is. We have no idea. Doesn't that – it's better than Star Trek. It's like, you know, trying to figure that stuff out.
All of these questions that we can't yet answer, but that we're excited about finding more about. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Science Friday host Ira Flatow. Is there enough Science Friday, notwithstanding, is there enough science reporting in general, particularly when it comes to the electronic media? I mean, you and I probably both remember growing up, and it seemed like every network had like Jules Bergman on ABC.
Jules Bergman, Luke Jules, yes. There was a golden, you know, the golden age of science reporting, I guess, was in the 60s, but that meant that most science reporters were covering the moon space race. That was what science reporting really was. There were other science reporters around, like Walter Sullivan in the New York Times, other science reporters doing other things. But it was focused, like Jules was, on the space race. Then when news was always, back in those days, was always a lost leader in the business. The news departments were losing money. We had Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley and all those people. Those news departments were never made any money for anybody. So how did you distinguish your news department from someone else's? You made it the best. They spent their money where they could on making it really the best. We can brag that Cronkite's better than Brinkley or whatever, and we can brag about how good our news department is. Well, came the 70s, and people discovered that by making happy news – people bantering around, the weatherman's bantering with everybody else, that could raise the audience, and then they could start making money on the news. And if they could make money on the news, they had to make money on the news. So they started, you know, slashing and burning things and cutting back on news budgets. And the first thing that people always cut back in the news divisions is science reporting. There used to be 70 newspapers with science sections in them. Now there may be a handful or so with them. When times go bad, they cut science reporting out. Even CNN, when President Obama was just elected president and he announced that he's going to make science, give science its rightful, put it back in its rightful place in research, CNN fired its whole science, Miles O'Brien and his whole, they were all fired. And just when science is trying to get more into the news, so. So we're one spot where you can still get all that good stuff you might have gotten other places.
How are you getting kids interested in science other than in, you know, trying to be the next person that builds a $3 million app or whatever?
Well, we have a whole effort. We have a whole division now. It's just building up a division for science education. We take our videos that we make. And we make educational videos out of them. We have – people don't realize we have hundreds of videos on our website that people can watch in their own time. They can download our apps, take the app. The app will take the video and you can watch it whenever you'd like, or the radio show. And we're also distributing these things to teachers. Plus, we're creating new educational opportunities. We have something called the Science Club now, where we are – you know, there's a book club where you tell everybody, hey, let's all read the same book. We'll come back and discuss it over coffee or something. Well, we're telling everybody, hey, this is a project we all want you to work on, a science project. We'll give it out. You got a month to work on it. Send us a video of your project, and we'll share that video online on our website. And we've done that once now. We did the first one was create a machine that draws art, that creates art somehow. And we had we have dozens and dozens of people who submitted their projects. We have these motors that are zipping around on a desk with a pen on it, and they're tracing stuff around on the, you know, all kinds. We have pendulums that are swinging. We've had the videos come in, and we had one classroom where one of the students took his web camera, and he just went around from one desk to the other watching the stuff that was going on the desks. It's a beautiful little video there on our website, and you could watch all these kids with their science projects. And so we are reaching out to schools, making it easy for them to take advantage of the science and teaching materials that we make. And we'll have more in the club, you know?
I'm guessing there are a lot of people out there who are really interested in how you got interested in science as a kid. What kind of set off the spark for you, Ira Flatow?
I was the kid with the pocket protector. You know, I had all the a geek back then. Now it's geek. We were nerds back then. Yeah, I had the white socks and everything. I was one of these kids that was always very interested in science. I wanted to take things apart. I used to repair old black and white TV sets in my basement or take them apart or build science fair projects, blow things up. And so I was naturally interested in it. And I had a school teacher, Mrs. Pfeffer, in seventh, eighth grade, who had a science club after school and encouraged us and kept me interested in science. And when I went to school, I went to school in Buffalo, not too far from here, and I studied engineering, but I wasn't really good at it. But so I wanted to find something that would keep me interested, so I joined the radio station, WBFO in Buffalo. And I said, well, I'll go in and work the dials. In those days, we had dials.
Right? Slide pods.
That had needles that went back and forth on, right, meters and things. One day they wanted to beef up the news department because that was the age in the late 60s of the Vietnam anti-war demonstrations. And they were happening on campus and they wanted to go cover those. And they beefed up the news department and they asked for volunteers at the station. Anybody want to learn to become a reporter? And I looked around and I raised my hand. I said, I'll do that. So they literally threw a tape recorder and a microphone at me and said, okay, you'll learn on the job. You'll be an apprentice, you know. So I went out and started covering these things. I learned how to write it. I learned how to record it. I learned how to voice it. I had done a lot of theater in high school, so I was not afraid to be out there with, you know, talking about things. And that's how I started. And then I was looking for an excuse somehow to do more science while I was reporting. And the first Earth Day, 1970, rolled around. And I said, aha, here's an opportunity to do something, you know? And I did, and I found some experts on campus who could talk about Earth Day, and that's sort of when my science reporting career started. And then I happened to be lucky; I was in the right place at the right time. My boss, Bill Siemering, went to Washington, started All Things Considered, and I asked for a job, and he got me out of there, out of Buffalo in the cold, and down to Washington, and I worked there from 71 the first year till I started doing Newton's Apple in the 80s, then came back with Science Friday. It's been a long journey, but, you know, you're always learning something in this business. As you know, it's every day is very interesting because you're learning something new. And we're all about lifelong learning. And that's why I think listeners are very interested in Science Friday, because we're teaching them something new every day, every week, and they all love it.
It's the Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guest is Ira Flatow, Science Friday host. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about something that we were all interested in, and you mentioned that, you know, the great the giants of the science reporting in the past were really bringing people news about space exploration.
Right.
What is your take on the diminishing government support for space exploration and where it might be headed in the United States?
Well, there used to be only two players in the space race. There was the U.S. and the Soviet Union. We now have China, India, Japan, all these other countries that are talking about either going back to the moon. In fact, there are robots now on the moon that are not American. There's a Japanese robot. There's a rabbit. And they have all said that they would like to go to Mars also. So it's very expensive. We have wonderful robots on Mars doing incredible things, the rovers that go around there. There's always a debate in the science community. Do we send a person or do we send a robot? Someone who's a geologist will say, I can do with a hammer in one day what a robot can do in 3 years. And, because I don't know what I'm looking at. And they'll say, well, but that's going to cost 1,000 times what it costs to send a robot there. And I don't think, we talk about going to Mars, but it's very, very expensive. I think another country might go there first, and if not—
Which one would do that?
China.
Manned mission?
Yeah, could be. Could be China. China has a lot of money. They talk about their space program. We could. It's actually a law against us now. The Congress passed a law against us cooperating with China in space.
We may need to cooperate.
Well, think about it. They thought, the Congress said, well, maybe China's going to steal all our space secrets or all our rocketry secrets, Speaking of rocketry, we depend on rockets made by Russia.
Right.
To get up to the space station.
And there's all this political tension now. So where does that leave
we
that?
We could build.
Russians and the Americans have the most invested in the International Space Station.
Now, Elon Musk, who's built, SpaceX, says he could build those rockets for us if he got the contracts. But so there's a lot of, everything is being disrupted now, and the disruption is also going on in space and rocketry and whatever. I think if we wanted to spend the money and we wanted to share that burden with another country, we could probably go to Mars. And I think if we wanted to build our own rockets and be responsible enough on our own, we could do that also. And I think the way I read the tea leaves is that we are heading in that direction, at least for the rockets. Don't know about space because, the only way we got to the moon was that we did it in 10 years and we went through 3 presidents, Here, every time we change administration, some other president will say, oh, well, that was your idea. You need something that will last because it's going to take a while to do something like that. You need a commitment that is less political and is a longer commitment to get there. So you're talking about going to Mars. You're talking maybe 2030. That's a ways down and a few presidents away. So a few Congresses away. And then Congress has to decide that kind of science, that kind of investment in technology is something it wants to do. And right now, Congress does not look at spending a lot of money on science. And that's, people say, what do you do about that? I say, well, you have the power to vote. You have the ultimate power to decide how your money, it's your money that's being spent.
Coming up, we revisit our conversation with actor and activist George Takei. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.